Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
So let me hear you good and loud. All right, Gary. A one, a two, a three. Hey, we are to the
State player on 720 WGN. Harry Carey is one of the most famous and beloved sports broadcasters of all time, with a career that lasted over 50 years. Always a baseball fan, Carey once vowed to become a broadcaster who was the true voice of the fans, and he did just that. His distinctive style soon resonated across St. Louis, then Chicago, and eventually across the nation. In the new book, The Legendary Harry Carey, Baseball's Greatest Salesman, author Don Zminda delivers the first full-length biography of Carey since his death in 1998. It includes details of his orphan childhood, his 25 years with the Cardinals, his tempestuous 11 years with the White Sox, and 16 years he broadcast for the Chicago Cubs. And to join us to share some highlights of the new book, Don joins us tonight. Hey, Don.
Hi, Dave.
Great to have you. I'll tell you, this book of yours has been a long time coming. You thought about writing this over 20 years ago after Harry left us.
I really did. He's always fascinated me. I live in Los Angeles now, but I spent most of my developmental years in the Chicago area, and I was in Chicago for Harry's entire reign with both the White Sox and the Cubs.
Oh, that's great.
He's such a fascinating figure.
Absolutely.
And I'd always wanted to write about him.
First, tell us about your work with the Society for American Baseball Research.
Well, I've been a Sabre member for 40 years now. I joined it in 1979. It's an organization of researchers, statistical analysts, and historians. And although I've worked in sports for Stats Inc. and Stats LLC in analytics, most of the work that I've done for Sabre has been in the historical realm. Probably the most significant thing that I did was I put together a book about the 1959 White Sox to celebrate their 50th anniversary 10 years ago. And the book included biographies of every player who played on the team that year. And it's a labor of love and the kind of stuff that I love doing.
Well, great book. And I want to start with talking about, he called over 8,000 Major League Baseball games. And you note that he was most famous for his work with the Chicago Cubs at the end of his career. And in some ways, that's unfortunate. He broadcast until he was 83. He often struggled with names and at times had problems keeping up with their action. Comedians imitated him. Carey didn't seem to mind, but many people lost sight of what a talented broadcaster he had been. And famed broadcaster Bob Costas said that his greatest work had come decades earlier when Harry was broadcasting for the Cardinals.
Yeah, and he says that with good reason, because Carey was an outstanding technical broadcaster. Just the way he would describe the game made it exciting. There was a story that Skip Bayless wrote sometime in the 1980s about Harry and just how Harry could say "tutu" and get you worked up about the ball and strike count.
He just
had so much energy.
Now, you mentioned about the Sox, too, that Carey arrived just after a season with the White Sox, which the team lost 106 games and had drawn fewer than 500,000 fans. His popularity gave the team an enormous boost, but so did a better product on the field. And with the Cubs, his work became available to the entire country via WGN-TV. I mean, that's really what kind of threw him into national stardom.
Well, that's what everybody remembers him for, and with good reason. I mean, he really became a national celebrity, especially with the WGN Superstation going out to the entire country. But while he deserves his fame for that, I really did feel that the Cardinal years and White Sox years were equally significant. I mean, he's a Hall of Fame broadcaster, but I think you could argue with perfect truth that Harry could have been a Hall of Fame broadcaster for each one of the three clubs that he broadcast for, the Cardinals, the White Sox, or the Cubs. Any of those three teams would have earned him a spot in the Broadcasters Hall of Fame.
Well, and you mentioned, too, about the Cubs winning the World Series. You know, sweet for Cubs fans everywhere, but it's totally true that there were people associated with the Cubs that everybody talked about almost immediately after they won. that, oh my God, they weren't here for this. They sat through hundreds of games, decades, a century of losses. And, you know, you mentioned at the Cubs celebratory rally in Grant Park, host Pat Hughes paid tribute to what he called the Mount Rushmore of Cubs legends. Ernie Banks, of course, who had died in January 2015. Ron Santo, the beloved Cubs player and broadcaster, who died in December 2010. Jack Brickhouse, the team's longtime broadcaster, who died in August 98. And Harry Carey, the man who succeeded Brickhouse in the team's broadcast booth and died in 98. Even though, unlike Banks and Santo, Harry never played a game, his 16 years with the team was less than half as long as Jack's, but made such an impact on broadcast history, but in baseball.
Well, it's really true. He became so identified with the Cubs. And really, during those superstation years, he really sold Wrigley Field and the whole Cub experience to the entire country. I mean, there were people on the West Coast and the East Coast and the South, the Northwest, wherever, that would watch those Cub games on WGN, because that was when cable really started going out to the whole country. And they became sold on Wrigley Field. So the Cubs, I think, were always, to a degree, a national franchise. But certainly Harry and WGN made them much more of a national franchise than ever before. And Harry just brought that whole Wrigley Field experience to life. And it's continued with him. You know, what a lot of people don't realize is that when Harry came to the Cubs in 1982, the Cubs were probably a little bit more popular a team in the Chicago area than the White Sox, but it was probably like 60-40. And there were a lot of years that the White Sox would outdraw the Cubs. But within a few years of Harry coming to the Cubs started moving well ahead of the White Sox. And I think this year will be the 34th or 35th year in a row that the Cubs are outdrawing the White Sox. And it's not even close. It's more than a 2-to-1 margin. And a lot of the credit for that goes to Harry.
How much of that, his move from the Sox to the Cubs, pissed off Sox fans, really?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question, because one thing that I discovered in doing the book was that when he moved from the White Sox to the Cubs, the Tribune did a survey. No, it wasn't totally scientific, because they asked people to write in, but they asked people to identify themselves as White Sox fans, Cub fans, or neutral fans, just general baseball fans. And one of the really interesting things was that among people who identified themselves as White Sox fans, over 40% of them said that they were going to follow Harry to the Cubs.
That's amazing.
So that's really, it really is. And at the same time, the people who were Cub fans, they didn't want Harry because he had been so identified with the White Sox. But part of Harry's magic is how he could just envelop himself with the team so quickly. And I would say probably halfway through his first year with the Cubs, he was totally a Cub man. And it just took off from there.
But you know as well as I do, living in the city, you're either a Cubs fan or a Sox fan. I mean, there's the line drawn right down the middle. And to say, I love the White Sox and I watch them with Harry Carey, but I'm going to follow Harry to the Cubs, I mean, that just says miles and mountains about what Harry brought to both teams.
While he brought the Wrigley experience to the country with the Cubs, you have to also realize that during his 11 years with the White Sox, that was an amazing experience as well. Like, one of the great experiences of my life was the Southside Hitman team of 1977, in which the White Sox battled for the pennant in the American League West for most of that season. They fell off toward the end of the year, but it was an incredibly exciting season, and it was the first season that Harry was teamed with Jimmy Pearsall. And I got so hooked on that team that I had a full-time job that I had to start very early in the morning. But I went to almost 40 games that year.
Wow.
And a lot of it was just because of the excitement that Harry and Jimmy brought, not only to the broadcast, but to the whole ballpark.
More with author Dom Zeminda and his new book, The Legendary Harry Carey, right after this on 720 WGM.
I use some cloud sportsman sparks at the bleachers during the week. And whatever it was, I came to the conclusion either that I was just lucky and only went to the ballpark when it was so exciting, or that the announcers didn't feel the game the way I did. The nuances and the positions and the way the pitcher was working and the way the outfielders moved around, the catcher set it up. All these things made an impression on me.
Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We're talking to author Don Zeminda. His new book is The Legendary Harry Carey, Baseball's Greatest Salesman. So Harry is so well known for his association with the Cubs. He worked for five different teams over the years. His first real radio gig was in Joliet, which I didn't know.
Yes, and in fact, this is an ironic thing. The little radio station that Harry worked for in Joliet turned out to be the White Sox flagship station in 1971, which was Harry's first year with the White Sox. The White Sox were so out of fashion and so out of favor that they could not get a Chicago radio station to broadcast their games, even after signing Harry. So they had to string together a group of little suburban stations that would come on at various points during the day. And one of them was the station in Joliet that became the White Sox flagship station. That was the station that Harry started out with.
Well, and then all the way back to 1945, he was with the St. Louis Cardinals after a quick stint in Kalamazoo. He also called games for the short-lived St. Louis Browns, which were, I think, once the Milwaukee Brewers. I think they moved to St. Louis, blah, blah, blah. But and the Cardinals radio network was big back in the day, especially when Harry was with them. At their height, they were with 87 stations across 12 states. I mean, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, he really had a lot to do with that. The Sporting News used to keep track of how many affiliates each major league team would have. And during those years, the Cardinals had more than twice as many as the next closest team, which in the early 1950s was the Milwaukee Braves. And Harry really was largely responsible for the growth of that network.
Now, he had a lot of partners over the years, and you mentioned Pearsall, but Carey had two new partners in the 1950s in the broadcast booth, and that was Milo Hamilton and Jack Buck. Interesting relationships he had with them.
He did. You know, Harry was a wonderful man and a fabulous broadcaster, but when he was in the broadcast booth, he wanted to be the number one man. He did not want anybody to challenge him. And he got along. He was in the broadcast booth in the 50s with Milo first, and then Jack Buck came on that same year. Buck and Carey got along pretty well, because while Buck is a fabulous broadcaster himself, Buck was very content to be the number two man behind Harry. Milo always wanted to be a number one man himself. He and Harry didn't hit it off from the first. Milo lasted 1 year in St. Louis, and of course, eventually he ended up with the Cubs. And after he starts solding it with the Cubs, who comes in but Harry?
Right. Which didn't work out very well. You know, he had a number of partners that were household names over the years, and George Garagiola and Steve Stone. And, you know, did he have a favorite or one he might have considered as his most successful relationship?
You know, the guy that he talked about the most was his very first broadcast partner. It was an old major league catcher named Gabby Street, who had been played in the early days of the 20th century and then became a Cardinals manager and coach and then a broadcaster. And when Harry moved to the Cardinals, he was teamed up with Gabby Street. And during that first year or so, Street was actually more famous in St. Louis than Harry was. But Street was kind of like Jack Buck. Street understood that Harry was going to be the number one man. He was content to be Harry's sidekick, and they got along beautifully.
Now, people always say, well, Harry never got to see a World Series. He did, of course, with the Cardinals in 64, 67, and 68. He broadcast those with Jack Buck. He also called football and hockey and basketball in his early career as well.
Yeah, he did. That was one thing that surprised me, and he did a lot of football. He was the voice of the University of Missouri football team for a number of years. He also did a lot of Notre Dame games, and he used to do the Cotton Bowl every year.
Right.
Basketball, he did St. Louis Hawks games. I think when the St. Louis had a team in the ABA, he did those games too. And in fact, it was while doing one of those basketball games that Harry hooked up with Elvis Presley when he was doing a game out of Memphis.
Wow. Now, after some research, you know, obviously he's so tied into the phrase, holy cow. Kurt Smith, who I've also had on this program, noted that Harry wasn't the first guy to utter the words, holy cow.
No, he wasn't. There were actually a couple minor league broadcasters going back to the 1930s that used that phrase. And I don't know whether Harry heard it or not, but Harry picked it up as his catchphrase pretty early in his broadcasting career, even before he went to the major leagues. So he wasn't the first to use it, but he was the first certainly to use it and popularize it on a major league level, and it really became his from then on.
So then,
Tony Rizzuto notwithstanding.
So now that after 25 years with the Cardinals, that part of his life ended. What happened after 25 years? I mean, he was so associated with the Cardinals for so many years.
Well, you know, it's a little bit of a mysterious story. There were a lot of rumors in St. Louis that Kerry was involved in a relationship with the wife of Gussie Bush's son. And whether there was truth to that or not, a lot of people believed it. Harry kind of played along with the story for a while. Eventually, he denied it. Ms. Bush didn't talk about it for a long time. In the 90s, she gave an interview in which she said they were close, but they weren't intimate. But St. Louis is a small town, and a lot of people believe the rumors. That was not holding up too well with the Budweiser people, not only because it was Gussie Bush, the wife of Gussie Bush's son, but also because Budweiser was a pretty conservative organization. But it was more than baseball. I think by that time, a lot of people felt that Harry had just become bigger than the team. And even as a beer salesman, sometimes Harry could become so raucous that people inside the Budweiser industry weren't so sure he was great for the brand. Of course, they would change their tune once Kerry went to the Cubs. But back then, there were people inside the company that were convinced that he wasn't helping beer sales all that much. And there was an incident early in the season when the Cardinals were playing in Montreal. Montreal had a brand new major league team. It was their first game. They were very excited about getting baseball. They had this converted minor league park, and they played the Cardinals in the first game. And Harry spent the whole broadcast running down the Expos and the stadium and the condition of it and how this was a disgrace to Major League Baseball. A lot of people took offense to that. And in fact, they wrote into Gussie Bush complaining about Harry's inhospitality toward the Expos. And Gussie Bush actually wrote a public letter to these people apologizing for Harry. And that was a really unusual step because Bush had always been Kerry's biggest ally for all those years in St. Louis. So you could see that the tide was kind of to turn against Harry for a number of reasons. It kind of just all piled up, and it was just time for him to move on.
But, I mean, part of what he did was he was brutally honest, and I think that's why the fans really connected to him, because he obviously, you know, he spent a little time, you know, a year in Oakland in a great chapter called Siberia that you have in the book. But then back to the White Sox, I mean, he butt heads with everybody with the White Sox organization.
Yeah, he did. You know, his years with the White Sox were the most contentious. He did not get along with Chuck Tanner, who was the manager when Harry came in. You could almost say that Harry's first 2 years with the White Sox were a campaign on Harry's part to get rid of Chuck Tanner. He did not get along with Roland Heeman, who's a wonderful man and a fine general manager. Harry didn't think much of him either. And there are a number of players that Harry was not convinced were helping the White Sox. The most notable example of that was Bill Melton, who had been a home run champion his first couple of years that he became a star with the White Sox, and then developed back trouble and really stopped becoming a decent player. And Harry just took it out on him night after night. The fans booed Melton mercilessly. It got to the point where finally in the mid-70s, the White Sox traded Melton to the Angels. And Melton said, if they hadn't traded me, I probably would have quit because of Harry.
And David Condon, I was looking at this in the Tribune, you quote him, that Harry left the White Sox at the altar when it was time to renew vows in that tumultuous marriage and signed for 2 years as a broadcast bigamy with the Cubs. Well, there goes the Tribune Company. So there was obviously some concerns about Harry coming over to the Cubs.
Yeah, one of the interesting things that I found out in writing the book was that it was definitely not a slam dunk deal on the part of the Cubs to bring Harry over, despite his enormous popularity. A lot of people were concerned about his image and how that would mesh with the Tribune Company's kind of staid conservative image. And there were a few people inside the Tribune Company that were convinced that Harry would really help. And they were able to sell bringing Harry over to the other people who were doubters. And, you know, within a few months, it was obvious that they had made the right move.
Well, I'll tell you, Harry's legacy with the Cubs, of course, was was really at the height and at the end of his career. Grant DePorter of Harry Carey's Restaurant certainly has helped keep his legacy alive as well. And I know we've only touched upon a few of the stories in this great new book. It's called The Legendary Harry Carey, Baseball's Greatest Salesman. It is available now wherever books are sold. Don, great stories in this book. I really enjoyed it. Great journalism, just talking to all these great fans and doing the research. It was fascinating to hear some really great and unique stories about this legendary broadcaster.
It was a pleasure, Dave.
Thank you, sir. All right, TV icon Henry Winkler is joining us next on 720 WGN.